Golf Smarter number 144 for September 16, 2008.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Achieving peak performance with Dr. Michael Lardon.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week we tap the best minds in golf to help lower your scores with tips, drills, insights, and advice. In conversation with course pros, architects, authors, players, teaching gurus, and coaches, here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thanks for downloading another episode of the Golf Smarter Podcast. Boy, golf is amazing, isn't it? There are so many topics to cover that are relevant to improving your game. We talk about the swing. We talk about strategy, your clubs. Last week, we dedicated a show to your body. Today, we'll go back into your mind. Our guest is a colleague of one of our listeners down at UC San Diego. Dr. Michael Lardon is a sports psychologist who has worked with many well-known PGA, LPGA, NFL, and Olympic athletes. Actually, I've got a behind-the-scenes story about this interview. Whenever a recording is about to begin, I let the guest know that if I ask something that they're not comfortable answering, we can edit it out. Look, I'm not here to be confrontational. My goal is to get tips and advice on how to improve our game. So let me promise you that you've not missed much, because this was the very first time in nearly 3 years that after the conclusion of the recording session, I was asked to remove a section. So if you'd like to fill in the blanks, during this interview, I brought up the topic of a very famous, very wealthy, yet unproductive LPGA and PGA wannabe tour player and college student. Since Dr. Lardon has worked with this player and her family, he said that he'd rather not go public with his opinions. We respect his wishes as not to publish the content. So, today we talk with Michael Lardon about how to improve our game and our lives from his book, Finding Your Zone, 10 Core Lessons for Achieving Peak Performance in Sports and in Life. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, Fred.
How are you? Thank you for joining us via Skype today.
My pleasure to be here, Fred.
You have a great new book that's out called Finding Your Zone, 10 Core Lessons for Achieving Peak Performance in Sports and in Life. That's the part that really intrigued me, is that you found a way that people can correlate both of those things, because we're always looking to find peak performance. Can we find peak performance? Can we achieve it?
Well, we certainly can learn the skill set that helps us better optimize our chance of achieving peak performance. And really how that was for me, Fred, how that came to fruition was an organic process where my career kind of was in parallel. I work as a regular general psychiatrist, and then for the last 15 years, half of my practice has really been with Olympic athletes and PGA Tour athletes. And what I've found over the years is the concepts I use with my regular clients, everyday people, and the concepts that I use with elite athletes are really one and the same. And it's that experience that led to me writing the book.
How do you quantify this? How are you able to, you know, as a scientist, how do you say, we found peak performance with this person?
Well, that makes me rewind a little bit. And to try to give you the short story, when I was a kid, I played table tennis on the U.S. team, and I had an experience where I was kind of in the zone in the finals of the U.S. Junior Championships. And that intrigued me my whole life, because it was a qualitatively a different state, where the ball in table tennis goes 100 miles an hour. It came to me in slow motion. And then when I was at college, my lab partner was Eric Heiden, who had just won 5 gold medals, and he and I became very close friends. And he told me about similar experiences for himself. And then as my academic training went on, I became very interested in the science, in the quantification of this experience. And so that first started in the early 90s when we were awarded a grant by the United States Tennis Association to first define, is there a zone? So we interviewed a litany of world-class athletes from all sports, and really everyone had a very similar experience where at times in their life in sport. They were in the zone. And then we brought those athletes to Scripps Research Institute in a very fancy brainwave lab where we did all these very fancy tests. And we were able to show to some degree that there is a scientific validity to this concept that the brain operates in this more efficient, instinctive way when people are really doing their best, whether it's in sport or not. And that's really the science, and that work I did in the early 90s. And then the other part of the equation was, okay, well, you have all this science, but how do you help the everyday person and the elite athlete get access to the zone? So how do we merge some of the scientific studies with really the practical application? And so my book is really more a narrative of the concepts that I see that are universal among the great athletes that I've had exposure to in my life. So there's a little bit of a jump. I mean, we can't say we're not at the level where we can say, yep, these 10 concepts, if you've integrated them in your life, they equate to you being in the zone. But we really do have a sense that the zone is a valid state of consciousness that people can access, and we do see the great athletes get into it more often, and then they share among themselves, they share these kinds of tenets, if you will, that have helped them get to the place, get to that peak performance in their life and in their sports.
I would like for you to tell the story about when you first discovered you were in the zone when you were playing table tennis. You were in a great match. I related to it not because I've been at that level of competition, but you didn't know you were in the zone, and then you got knocked out of it, right?
Well, yeah, and that's often what happens. I mean, we see this happen with tour golfers all the time where all of a sudden they're making birdies and they're in a trance, and then they look up and then their name is up on the leaderboard, and ba-boom, they fall out of that place. But for me, in 1976 at Caesars Palace, I found myself in the finals of the United States Junior Championship. I was seated 12th, and the guy I was playing, his name was Perry, he was the perennial national champion, and he really was a much better player than me at the time. And the ball in table tennis at 100 miles an hour, that's the speed it travels, it started to slow down for me. And I could smash his topspin drive at will. I could chop. I could almost do anything. And I won the first two games very handedly, and I was in this kind of dreamy, trance-like state. And then, ironically, my coach was so shocked at what was going on. He said some comment like, this is going to be one of the biggest upsets in U.S. table tennis history. And the moment he said that, I was like, oh, my gosh. What's going on? And then all of a sudden, Perry's topspin drive started coming 100 miles an hour again and whizzing by me. So I sort of fell out of that place. And it was unfortunate in the sense that I didn't win the national championship that year. But the silver lining was it always stuck with me. And it really gave me the motivation for the rest of my life to learn about peak performance. And that's how my career unfolded.
Very interesting story. So for most people, and we're not talking about elite athletes now, but for most people, when they're in a zone, as opposed to the zone, when they're in a zone, do they know it?
Well, I mean, I think we often know it afterwards. And in 93, when we went out to really study this phenomenon and interview people from all domains of life, not only great athletes, we were a little bit surprised to find that almost everybody, without exception, would report. I can remember a teacher describing, you know, days where they were teaching and the lessons just kind of came out of them and the class was riveted. And then in retrospect, you look back and you say, you know, I was really rocking that day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure there are days when you do your podcast that, you know, you do really well with the interview and everything just flows. So one of the paradoxes is if we sort of recognize we're in the zone, if we fall out of it, and it's really something we look back, we have to kind of look back a little bit and say, hey, I think I was really kind of zoning that day, or I was in my groove.
And so the issue then is falling out of it. And then trying to regain it for a competitive athlete, I would think if they recognize, oh my God, I'm really playing out of my mind here, don't lose it or get back in it. Can you consciously do that?
Well, that's the point. That's the key. And the problem is if you try to regain it and you push to regain it, it's very hard to do. Mm. And really, the way we help people maximize staying in the zone is to teach them about the pitfalls. So that's, you know, those are things like, I think a good example was when Rich Beem in the 2002 PGA Championship was coming down the end, and he hit a great 5-wood in on one of the final holes there and made eagle. He knew that after that place, if he started thinking about, okay, I could beat Tiger and be the PGA champion, he intuitively knew that that would take him out of the zone. And his conversation, and it has been recorded with his caddy, who's a great caddy, Billy Heim, is, you know, let's just stay with each shot ahead, and if we do our job, we'll worry about the results later. So the way we stay in the zone is we really don't let our mind go, although as seductive as it may be to go and think, oh gosh, I could win the PGA Championship or win this or that, or it's to not go there, to just stay with what you're doing. I always say you'll have plenty of time, you know, at the end of your career to look back and appreciate all the accolades. But when you're in the middle of it, you stay focused at the task at hand.
I recently had a round of golf that I was playing incredibly well on a course that usually owns me. And after my drive on 18, I put it right in a fairway, and I said to the guy I was with, boy, you know, I shouldn't say this, but I've been playing really well today. I've been striking the ball really well today. And I triple bogeyed the hole.
Well, I mean, it reminds me of a funny story, and it's embarrassing for me to tell it as a you know, mental coach to athletes, but I'm a low handicap golfer, and for years I struggled to shoot par, and I would be right at shooting par, and I'd always make a bogey on the last hole and just couldn't really do it, and my brother would kid me. And then one time at the San Diego Country Club, we were out there, and I was 4 under par on the 18th hole, and I mean, these are the thought processes I don't want to preach to people, but I said to myself, well, heck, I could hit it out of bounds even and make double bogey, and I'll still make par. And sure enough, when I realized that I could even hit it out of bounds and still make par, I said, that's a silly thought. Don't go there. And I hit it down the middle and ended up for the first time breaking par. And then afterwards, it wasn't that hard. So it was that mental kind of boundary I had in my mind that I had to work with. But that's a great example of how not to think from the mental coach.
Right, right. So how do people achieve this in their work lives beyond sports?
Well, I mean, I think the concept is it's really having mental discipline or good mental hygiene. And that is, you know, we only have so much energy, mental energy every day, and we want to use it most efficiently. Now, what happens is people kind of worry throughout the day, and they're always focused a little bit on this. You know, it's like we live in a culture of ADD, attention deficit disorder. I mean, I think things, cell phones and Palm Pilots and all the technology have even made our ability to stay in the moment more difficult. But we try to teach the skill set that, you know, what you want to accomplish that day, you compartmentalize. Okay, I want to work at this. I want to work out now. This is a time I want to relax. So it's learning to have the quality of time and being really present, whether it's with your daughter, like my little 4-year-old I took to breakfast this morning. I really try to make it my business to really be with her in that time. And not worry about, you know, doing a podcast with Fred at 10 and or going to the hospital later this afternoon. So I think, you know, our culture, our Western culture now doesn't really reinforce being in the present. And this is, I think, a good lesson for all of us. And we will do better in life, in our personal life and our professional life, if we follow some of these basic fundamental principles.
Well, that's really an excellent point. So if you don't mind, we're not going to give away the content of the book completely here. And it is available on our website at golfsmarter.com. Go to the Smarter shopping page, and the book is available. You can purchase it through Amazon. If you can, you have 10 different principles on how to get yourself and you know, put yourself, stay in the zone. Can we go by them one at a time and just briefly give an overview of it?
And then I'm happy to do that.
Thank you.
You know, in no specific order, I think one of the concepts to try to help people be in the present and you know, I call it instant amnesia. I say Tiger Woods really embodies instant amnesia, meaning, you know, he can hit a bad shot and then that shot's gone and he's able to always approach the next shot fresh, where even some of the best tour players in the world, they hit a bad shot, it sort of rocks their confidence a little bit, and it bleeds into the next shot. And that happens to, you know, us as amateur golfers all the time. So a practical drill that I use with the players, I talk about it in the book, is what I call make a zone card or the two scorecard drill. And essentially what that is this. We all know the regular scorecard where we make bogeys and birdies and pars, and everybody always keeps that. But the other kind of scorecard that I ask people to pay attention to is each shot, regardless of the result, when you stepped into that shot, were you clear with the kind of shot you want to hit, meaning, okay, it's 160 yards and I want to hit a cut 6 or 7 iron in, and then when you stepped into that shot, you know, are you fully committed, and did you release that shot without any trepidation, with full commitment? Like Tiger Woods, you always see him pull out of a shot in the middle of his backswing. And what he's doing is really the zone card in his own way, where if he doesn't feel fully committed to that shot, he is not going to take the swing. Now, amateur golfers, heck, we could be thinking about anything in the middle of our swing. So how we judge this card is, if we hit that driver on the first tee, and even if it rolls through the fairway and goes in the rough, but we were fully committed and we were present when we were hitting it, we give ourselves a yes. Conversely, we may hit a perfect shot and it may end up 5 feet from the pin, but we were distracted in the middle of the swing, and even though the result of the shot's good, we would give that shot a no. And what we find is the best tour players in the world only can answer yes about 80-85% of the time, meaning that, you know, they were not distracted when they hit the shot, regardless of the result. And what I'll ask them, I'll say, well, do you think you could do it just 5% more? You know, do you think you could do a little better job of really being impeccable and really making sure that you're fully concentrated when you hit the shot? And uniformly, they'll say yes. And at the level of a tour player, one shot could be the difference of keeping your card for the year or not. Now, amateur golfers, we probably only are fully committed with each shot less than half the time. So there's all this room for improvement. So if we could get anywhere up to 3/4 of the time, you know, making sure we put our cigar down or our beverage down and taking really the time to be present and hit the shot, it will, in fact, help all our games. So that's what we call the two scorecard and learning to be in the process. And the two scorecard is a very practical drill. So at the end of your round, you go through all your shots and you say, was I really present and committed? And that's a yes. Or if I wasn't, it was a no. And you get a percentage. And that's a good way to think about your round to help you stay in the present.
That's excellent. I know that since I've been doing this podcast, I've received emails from a lot of people, and personally, that scores have gone down. And I think it's because of the mental aspect of the game that we're improving on, and not beating yourself up, and you know, after a shot. One of the things that I like to do, and I can get distracted so easily on so many things, even if I step up to the tee box and I'm standing on a broken tee, that will distract me. You know, if my feet aren't level, that will distract me. And I'll pay for it in my shot. So what I've started doing is, what I like to take is a mental mulligan. right? I'll walk away from it.
That's a great idea.
I'll walk away from it. Go, okay, I'm going to start again here. I'm going to try to, you know, get all these distractions out of my mind and just walk away, as opposed to taking a bad shot and, you know, getting angry with myself. Just walk away and start again.
Well, the beauty of taking a mental mulligan is that, one, you can. There's no penalty for that.
Right.
And two, in golf, we have the ability to initiate the action. Mm. So if you're not ready, you should take advantage of it. Golf is different than tennis
or table tennis,
where once it's in motion, you can't do anything. But golf, i.e. Tiger Woods, you know, stopping in the middle of his backswing. I mean, if you're not ready, you don't have to complete the swing. And if you don't complete the swing, it doesn't count. So you have the luxury of engaging in the shot when you're ready to. And that's really one of the key components.
Hmm. All right, let's go to another one. Since we're not going to take them in order, where would you like to go with next?
Well, you know, I think an interesting one is anxiety and fear. So, mm-hmm. you know, people will say, oh, you know, Doc, I'm so fearful of this shot. I'm so anxious. And the, one of the first things I explain to people that in my career helping professional athletes, nobody is never not anxious. You can be sure that when Tiger Woods tees off on the first tee of the U.S. Open, even Tiger Woods is anxious. And so in a way, we give permission to have a little anxiety. I remember I played with Mark Calcavecchia when they had the World Match Play at here at La Costa one year, and I was very nervous on the first tee. And, you know, I'm a low handicap golfer, and believe it or not, I hit a grounder. And I remember Mark said to me, he said, you know, obviously you and your brother have two different fathers. And really, he was really, because my brother's been on the PGA Tour for a number of years.
Okay.
But the point is that the critical distinction is to not let it bleed into fear. And how that works is this. A lot of people don't understand the difference between fear and anxiety. Anxiety is the physiologic sensation, you know, where your heart rate's coming up. But anxiety in and of itself gives us a little bit of an adrenaline rush that makes us stronger and makes us focus a little more. Fear is when there's a sense of impending doom. And through evolution, those two things are often coupled. Because, you know, in prehistoric man, when there was anxiety, there was often something to really be fearful of. Now, if you're in the ocean and a great white shark's coming at you, that's normal to have fear with anxiety, and you need to get out of there. But what I might tell a golfer is, okay, you're a little anxious, and we're on the, 18th hole of TPC Sawgrass, and there's the water on the left there, but let's talk about the fear. Well, Doc, I'm feeling really fearful. And then I might say, well, you could hit it in the water, and what will happen if you hit it in the water? And then the person says, well, I'll have to drop it, and I'll probably make double bogey. And then I'll say, well, will you still be around tomorrow if you make double bogey? And, you know, uniformly the individual will say yes. And I said, can you live with making double bogey if that's the worst thing that happens? And then the person says yes. And then I said, okay, so you don't really have to be afraid of it. So let's use that little adrenaline rush to our advantage. And you see that target line? That target line's over there. It's not the water. So let's take a minute. Let's not worry about the water. We can live with it if we have to, but let's fire it at the target. So just differentiating the difference between anxiety, which can be helpful, and the natural inclination of human beings to bleed it into fear, but really showing them that there's really nothing to truly be afraid of, that lets people be free, and that lets the fear dissipate and lets them use the anxiety as a real positive thing.
This is a topic that we talk about a lot on this show and on all Golf Smarter Tips program that we do with Michael Anthony. He talks about anxiety and fear a lot, so that's great confirmation. I wanted to move over to lesson one that you have in the book about dream.
Well, dream is, you know, a fascinating thing. We spend a third of our life asleep, and so that's a large chunk of our life, and what we don't realize is that there's tremendous mental activity when you're sleeping, and that's really the state of consciousness where your unconscious is really doing its thing. And I always like to say we're the noisiest passenger of our own ship, meaning our unconscious really drives our life, and really deep in our unconscious, that's where our desires and our aspirations live. And we live in a day and age where dreams aren't really, you know, they're not really valued as much as they are in one Eastern world or in times before ours. Now, I was fortunate enough at Stanford University to work in the Sleep and Dream Center, which is among the most renowned in the world. And through that experience, I was exposed to Jonas Salk, who taught us a class, and he's the inventor of the polio vaccine, and I tell about it in my book. But he had a dream where he would dream about the polio virus night after night, and he had a lucid dream, meaning he could control the dream. And through the lucid dream, he learned the weakness of the virus, and then in the ensuing weeks was able to develop the vaccine. And that's the story he tells. And I tell some other scientific examples of how important the dreams were. Now, to go over to the world of sports, there is no great athlete who's achieved great things that hasn't dreamt of these things, you know, since their childhood. Now, we all can remember, or I'm sure most of us, being real young and practicing with your buddy and pretending it's the U.S. Open and this putts for the playoff and the win. And it's those are the seeds that really lead to greatness. So I like to say, you know, the winner of the U.S. Open isn't necessarily the guy who did it all that week, but it's been done from years and years ahead. You know, Phil Mickelson, when he won his first Masters, you know, people said, you know, what was different? But Phil Mickelson has been mirroring his dad's swing since the age of 2 or 3. I play at the same golf club as he here in San Diego now. And so this is, you know, dreams are a very important piece of our emotional and mental life for us to really pay attention to. And it could be a daydream or it could be dreams at night. So keeping a dream journal sort of teaches us about ourselves, teaches us what we really want. You know, we generally don't dream about getting Lamborghinis and Ferraris and material things. We generally dream about things that really have great meaning for us. And it's those things that if we dream about and they become our goals, that we end up developing great motivation and strength to go ahead and achieve that.
And I think that really does lead into lesson 7 that you have about keeping your motivation pure.
Well, that's a really interesting thing because, you know, when you're young and you play a sport or whatever endeavor it is, playing the piano, you do it generally because you love it. And this is, let me segue to Tiger Woods. You know, people say, what makes Tiger so special? And, you know, his dad was a special forces guy. And there's all the famous stuff about his dad yelling in the middle of his backswing and jingling his keys. But what people don't realize is that Tiger Woods's dad, was very gentle with Tiger and supportive. Tiger always had to do his homework first, and then golf was a reward. So he played golf always for the love of it, and he would get to go out with his dad, and they would play into the dark until he couldn't even find his ball. It wasn't about, you know, you have to play golf so you can, you know, win money and be famous. So you wonder what drives Tiger. You know, when he changed his swing and moved from Butch to Hank Haney, he was already one in the world. So he certainly didn't need to do that to be more famous or to make more money. But he did that because he inherently wants to be the best golfer he can be, because that's what's really fun. So we call that intrinsic motivation, because it comes from within. And it's easy to have your motivation change in the years, because if you become an elite athlete and you become famous, you know, you start to play into that piece and for what we call extrinsic motivation, for the accolades of others. But you have to be really careful with that. It's very seductive, but it also often will undermine the motivation that it takes to really keep your edge and really keep the discipline to perform consistently at the highest level. So that chapter really is a discussion of what makes up motivation.
Okay. Well, listen, what I want to do before we go is I want to talk about performance under pressure. And we're not just talking about golf.
Well, yeah, we're talking about life. And you know, pressure really is a perspective. So one of the ways to perform really well under pressure is to be comprehensively prepared. So I like to use the analogy of a computer. So in a computer, we have our hard drive and then we have our RAM. And if we're running too many programs at once, like we're doing this interview on Skype, and you wisely told me, you know, hey, Mike, close the other programs because we don't want to overload the computer. So similarly, if we're out there in the heat of competition, we don't want to have to worry about, you know, what's going on technically in our swing. We want to have done our homework ahead of time so we can have fun with the experience. And, you know, what comes to mind is in sports right now is Brett Favre is big in the media. He signed with the New York Jets yesterday. And how is Brett Favre, who's almost 40 years old with 16 seasons in the NFL and still as productive as he is in such a violent and taxing sport? And I'd say in a nutshell that Brett Favre is like the children playing in your backyard. He's out there, you know, how kids draw the pass patterns on their hand for, you know, if they're playing quarterback. I mean, that's what Brett Favre brings to the game. He has that sense of enjoyment. And if we really want to play well and play well under pressure, we have to learn to have fun with it. And really playing under pressure is a privilege. It's most fun when we are playing in competition and under pressure, and we want to embrace that challenge and have fun with that challenge rather than fear that challenge. And that's one of the things that we try to work with the athletes and amateur golfers alike, to have some fun with it too, even if you're playing at the highest level.
Oh, great stuff, Michael. Thank you so much. Again, the book is called Finding Your Zone, 10 Core Lessons for Achieving Peak Performance in Sports and Life by Dr. Michael Lardon. Michael, thanks so much for coming on and sharing this with us. And you should definitely pick up the book. Not you, Michael, you probably have a copy. But the audience members should definitely pick up a book because you're going to pick up stuff, you'll want to read stuff multiple times, and there's a great foreword by David Ledbetter in there that really puts a great perspective on all of it. Thanks, Michael.
Well, thanks, Fred. I really enjoy your show, and best of luck to you.
And if we didn't mention, you can check out this book and find it on golfsmarter.com at our Smarter Shopping section. Your purchase goes through our partnership with Amazon.com. Don't forget to enter to win a torpedo putter and a separate putter training aid so you have a chance to win multiple things. Both of them come from Timothy Winey, and we're actually giving away a couple of the training aids. Timothy was very generous about that, so go to golfsmarter.com and click on Contest. It's time for me to ask for a request. Now, Golf Smarter survives on advertising, not subscription rates. And if you could please take the time to fill out our listeners survey at golfsmarter.com. That's the kind of stuff that we show advertisers, what you think, what you do, how you listen, your thoughts, who you are. You know, we have to show who the audience is. So the listener survey at golfsmarter.com is one thing that we need and we request. And the other one is write a review on iTunes. If you subscribe on iTunes or if you subscribe on Odeo or wherever you find this program, first of all, we appreciate that you found it and that you are listening on a regular basis. Write a review. Let other people know what you think. And this is the kind of thing we also send advertisers back to say, this is what the audience is saying. So give some proof that you're out there and that you're listening. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. We close today's show with a quote that came from Martin Nalty that he found in the UK. It's another reminder of our expectations and what we should do with them. Jack Nicklaus said, "Professional golf is the only sport if you win 20% of the time, you're the best." Next week, Andy Thompson of Totally Driven. If you have any questions, quotes, comments, or suggestions, maybe even a question, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
The Good Dog Podcast is for people who are passionate about dogs.
I love my dogs.
I interview veterinarians, dog behaviorists, and a whole range of experts who offer tips and insights.
A good German Shepherd makes decisions. It will say, well, you know, I know the light just changed, but on the other hand, there's a very quiet Prius coming your way, and so I'm going to stop, whereas labs have a tendency to just follow rules.
You'll hear about some amazing canines who help their owners to be safe, and in some cases, alive.
Sometimes diabetics will test, and they'll still be at 100 saying, I'm not going low, what are you talking about? and the dogs let them know before they even feel it.
And you'll pick up ideas for solving a host of challenges.
Within a week, you're going to have a dog that is calm, he lies down quietly, he's just going to be a totally different dog.
I'm Joanne Green. Please subscribe to the Good Dog Podcast, found in iTunes or at smarterpodcasts.com.